The hashtag Why I Didn't Report took off last Friday after President Trump questioned why the woman accusing Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault didn't report the alleged assault when it happened more than three decades ago. Trump tweeted, quote, "The radical left lawyers want the FBI to get involved now. Why didn't someone call the FBI 36 years ago?" Users took to Twitter and elsewhere to share their own stories, thousands of them. Stories include survivors who didn't report assaults for a wide variety of reasons. Fear that they might face physical retaliation, threats against their own well-being or that of their family members, fears that they wouldn't be believed or because they were too young to understand what had happened. Others say they did report their assaults, only to have their stories downplayed by authorities and family members. By the way, the National Sexual Assault Hotline number is 1-800-656-4673. Kelly Mo Litke is the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She's with us now to talk about why it is that some choose not to report sexual assaults. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what are some of the kinds of things a survivor of sexual assault is weighing when they're deciding whether or not to come forward with their story?
Yeah, I think you touched on a lot of them. I think, you know, sexual assault is such a complex issue, and the decisions that survivors are making after an assault are coming from all different areas. It might be their personal support systems, who they have that they can support their access to services, as well as their relationship to the offender, the type of assault, their understanding of the issue of sexual assault, and what that means for them moving forward.
Do we have a sense of how often sexual assault might go unreported?
There's different research, and you know, the other thing that's interesting about sexual assault is that survivors can enter systems in a lot of different places. They might go to an emergency department, they might report to law enforcement, they might go to a service provider like a rape crisis center. What we know for reports to law enforcement is that it's estimated that 2/3 of survivors of sexual violence don't report to law enforcement.
Now, with a story like this one in the news, we're not going to dig into the details of this particular case.
Yeah.
What are you watching for as far as messages being sent to, sadly, past or future victims of assault?
I think it can go in a couple of different directions. We always appreciate when sexual assault is in the media because we know it is often such a hidden epidemic in our communities. And so we like to see people talking about sexual assault to sort of, you know, bring it out of those shadows. At the same time, we know that that can be really triggering for survivors. And we also see that, you know, survivors may be empowered by hearing all the stories and participating in the hashtag movements, whether it's Me Too or Why I Didn't Report. You know, so that they have control over their story and getting it out. At the same time, it can really weigh on people to be seeing those story after story after story through their Facebook feed or wherever they're seeing them.
Now, over the last few days, we've seen reports that national hotline I mentioned a few moments ago has seen a big jump. I've seen numbers 40% or 50% jump in the number of people calling in for their services. Is that something you're hearing, at least anecdotally, here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we've been hearing that since the start of the Me Too movement as well. We were hearing, you know, an increased calls to hotlines, increased drop-in for support groups, and, you know, we have programs across the state that are struggling with funding and providing support to survivors, and then this is an increase of calls and survivors they're serving.
Now, reading through the stories being told on that Twitter hashtag, for example, as someone who doesn't work on this field, it seems shocking, surprising how many people have this story of a unreported sexual assault. I assume, sadly, this is not a surprise to you.
Yeah, I mean, we hear these stories all the time, whether that's through people contacting us through Facebook. You know, we don't provide direct services, but we connect people to direct service providers across the state. And so, yeah, we're getting those calls and seeing those messages every day.
Can you talk about the kinds of services that are available here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. We've got wonderful service providers all across the state that are there just to listen. If that's what someone is reaching out for the first time and want to talk through their options, do they have options in reporting? Do they want, if it's something more immediate, do they have medical needs? Do they want to file a report? Advocates are available to help survivors make those decisions, to walk them through that process, whether it's been 5 minutes, 5 years, or longer since the incident happened.
Right. So they're not just there for someone to call and report something new that's happened. It might be somebody, I mean, again, looking at Twitter, people are talking about stories that happened 20, 30, In one case, I saw 60 years ago.
Absolutely. And there's support that can be provided. Some survivors may benefit from just talking one-on-one with an advocate to talk through that for the first time. They may decide to go to support group, or they may need other additional services. So there's lots of services that programs can provide regardless of the duration since the assault.
If someone calls, say, that national hotline, mm-hmm. What could they expect to happen?
Again, they're going to get that initial emotional support and validation that all survivors need to hear, that it's not your fault, and thank you for calling and reaching out, as well as trying to connect them to local services. So they'll ask where they're calling from to connect them to a local service provider.
We're talking to Kelly Molitke, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, about why survivors of sexual assault sometimes choose not to report their assault to law enforcement, or in some cases to anyone. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that we as a society have done enough to make people who are survivors of sexual assault be willing, comfortable to come forward? This is your story yourself. What did you think about when you're considering whether or not to talk about what happened or to go to law enforcement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up this conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Kelly Molitke of the Wisconsin Council Against Sexual Assault about why survivors sometimes choose not to report sexual assault to authorities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in this field, if you work with sexual assault survivors yourself, if you're somebody who is reported to in some capacity as an authority, if you've been through this story yourself and feel comfortable sharing that story, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kelly, part of our starting point, this social media movement, why I didn't report people who didn't report their sexual assault or did and had it ignored, makes me wonder, is there advice out there if someone is that friend or family member and somebody says, hey, this happened to me? Can you talk about how they can react in a supportive way?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that we can all do is believe survivors. And that seems really simplistic, but we see over and over again how poorly survivors are treated when they do come forward. And that's not just from these high profile cases that we're seeing in the media. This is every day when survivors are coming forward. So the easiest thing we can do is believe survivors when they come forward. There's always, there's safe things to say, like, I'm sorry this happened to you. It can be really shocking as well when someone discloses this, and so it may catch you off guard. And so thinking through what you might say, I'm sorry this happened to you, I believe you, and how can I help you? Because each survivor has to make their own decisions about what they want to do next. So them knowing that you're going to support them regardless what they decide and that you're going to be there for them is really, really important.
I'm guessing it's different from person to person, but can you talk some about the longer-term trauma somebody experiences, not just from the initial assault, but maybe from either being disbelieved or not being able to share the story at all.
And we hear from survivors in the years that I was, doing direct service advocacy, it wasn't uncommon for survivors to say the assault was bad enough, but then the treatment that I received afterwards by the response from systems and communities and even family and friends can just exacerbate a really difficult situation as it is. And so, all survivors are going to respond differently, and they're going to respond better the more support that they're given from all of those places.
Are we doing better over time as far as institutional responses, whether that's from law enforcement, medical authorities, and others?
I think that's what, at the Sexual Assault Coalition, that's what we're doing every day, is trying to train professionals. And we hope we're doing better than we were doing 5 or 10 years ago. But we know there's a long way to go. And particularly survivors of color and survivors from marginalized communities are facing additional barriers when they're trying to seek out, particularly to traditional systems like criminal justice and medical systems.
Now, for the support systems we were talking about earlier, the ones in counties around Wisconsin, for example, do they have enough resources to give the kind of help that people might need?
Absolutely not. And that's always the top of our legislative agenda, is to try get more funding for sexual assault service providers across the state, because, you know, this is a 24-hour-a-day job. Sexual assault doesn't just happen from 8 to 5. And so we need support for programs year-round and, you know, 24 hours a day. And so that's an important piece of this work.
I want to bring on a caller now. Jasmine is with us in La Crosse. Jasmine, hi.
Hi. I wanted to share my story on why people don't come forward. So my freshman year of high school, I was brutally raped, and it was very tragic. And I came forward to the police, and they didn't do anything about it. They shamed me and told me that it was my fault. And it was really unfortunate that as a 14-year-old girl, I was shamed for something that was not my fault and that they blamed me. And my senior year of high school, I was raped again by my ex. And I was too scared to come forward after the second encounter with my police officers that I just didn't. And I think it all starts with what our justice system is doing. They are more worried about what I'm wearing and what I was doing than the actual actions that should have been taken to proceed and discipline.
Jasmine, thank you so much for calling. I'm very sorry that happened to you twice and the reaction you got. Thank you so much for sharing your story. If people are getting this message that, or even hearing the first time they're assaulted, Kelly, that they're not taken seriously, is that going to discourage future, as Jasmine said, future reporting of that?
Unfortunately, that's true. And thank you, Jasmine, for calling and sharing your story. And, you know, unfortunately, that story is true for a lot of people, that they're not believed, that they're blamed and shamed for what happened. And all we can do is continue to tell survivors that there are people out there who will support them, who will believe them, who will listen. And we're going to keep working to ensure that these responses improve.
So as we wrap up, Kelly, as we said, this issue is in the news right now. Are you hopeful that it's going to encourage people to tell their stories and encourage other people to listen to them?
I hope so. I think that's what we try to do in the sexual assault movement all the time, is to get people talking and acknowledging that this is a problem in communities all over the country. And so hopefully by starting these conversations early, we can talk about how to support victims. We can talk about how to prevent sexual violence from ever happening. And we can improve system responses to ensure when survivors come forward, they're supported.
Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kelly Mo Litke, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, talking about why some survivors decide not to talk about and not to report being the subject of sexual assault. Again, the National Sexual Assault Hotline number is 1-800-656-4673. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has a long legacy of beer brewing, and these days the rest of the country is getting in on the game too, with thousands of craft breweries opening up over the last decade or two. And a new project will help beer lovers and beer makers better understand how some of their favorite brews came to be. The Smithsonian Institution is compiling the history of American beer and brewing through documents, photos, and interviews. Teresa McCullough is the historian of the American Brewing History Initiative at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Teresa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, first, tell us about this project you're doing on American brewing history.
So I am the historian of the American Brewing History Initiative at the American History Museum. And the American History Museum, if any listeners have been here recently, you might have seen that we have done a really great job collecting the history of American cuisine and American winemaking. On our ground floor in the museum, we have a food history exhibition, which includes Julia Child's kitchen, which was transported in full down from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and installed here in the museum. But a few years ago, curators here had a sense that we had not done quite as full a job collecting on the history of American beer and brewing. And so that is where I come in. And my task is to travel the country and to document the history of brewing in America today. And I have a special focus on the stories of home brewing and craft beer.
That sounds fun.
It is, yeah.
And brewing has a great history because there's kind of, people think of the 1800s and this golden age where little breweries rose up all over the place, then the big brewers, and now something new is going on. And you said that's a lot of what you're tracking. Can you talk about what you're looking for as you tell the story of the history of craft beer?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, brewing is a uniquely useful subject for me as a historian because through beer and brewing, I can really speak to any major theme or event in American history, you know, whether you want to talk about the history of immigration or transportation or technological advances. Really, beer relates to all of those subjects, and it's been present in America since even before the nation's founding. America's first brewers were enslaved people and women. They were brewing in the home. But yes, we have a much, much different appearance to the brewing industry today in America. We have more than 6,500 breweries in this country. It's more than ever before in our nation's history. And this current era of brewing culture, which we call the craft beer revolution, it really began in the 60s, and it has showcased a very different approach to making and consuming beer than what preceded it. And so again, the museum had this sense that the first generation of craft brewers, first called microbrewers, they're still very much present on the scene, and so now is very much the time to collect their stories and to see if they have objects, documents, artifacts that they might want to donate to the Smithsonian collection.
Before we dig deeper into beer, it seems like there's a wider story here that that beer and wine and food and how we make it and consume it tells a bigger story about American history. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the beginning of craft beer is really it's a perfect example of this because in the 1960s in Northern California, that was when the American winemaking industry was really starting to boom, and then you have the start of what we know to be called California cuisine. It was this sense that American food dishes produced with locally available ingredients could be quite delicious and award-winning, and so brewers, home brewers at the time, looked around at the winemaking scene and the culinary scene and thought, this relates to beer, too. We, too, can make great beer in America and produce it here on this soil, and so methods of this time that brewers were using also, you know, drew very much from the kind of 1960s countercultural trends, the do-it-yourself movements of the 1970s. All of these things fed into the growth of microbrewing and eventually craft brewing.
So as you travel the country looking at the history of this craft brewing movement, what kind of things are you looking to collect? What kind of stories and I guess what kind of artifacts?
Mm-hmm. Well, and this has been a great challenge and a pleasure of the job to really arrive here with a blank slate and to think, you know, there has not been a really synthetic and scholarly collecting initiative that has looked at the entire scope of this recent era of brewing history. And so where should we start and what should we try to collect? And so being a historian, I wanted to begin at the beginning, and so I started with an initial collecting trip to Northern California, to the Bay Area. That's where some of these very important figures really began their work. And when I visit people like Fritz Maytag, who purchased Anchor Brewing Company in 1965, it was a 19th century brewery that had kind of struggled since Prohibition, and he really revitalized it and showcased what a new small brewery could be at the time. People like Fritz Maytag or Ken Grossman, who founded Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, Michael Lewis, a professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis. When I speak with them, I ask them about objects that really kind of were transformative in their career or encapsulate their stories. You know, the Smithsonian wants things that are used and worn and, you know, show records of what they have done for the people that they belong to. And so, for example, Michael Lewis, this professor I mentioned, I was very honored to be able to collect his personal copy of the brewing textbook that he wrote. And he, just until very recently, he used this textbook to teach students in his brewing science lab. And the binding is totally broken, and when it arrived here in D.C., it was actually held together by a little purple rubber band that you would get. It said asparagus on it. It was an asparagus rubber band from the grocery store. But there were all kinds of, you know, notes in the margins and circles from his coffee cups. And it was very much an artifact of a teacher and a writer and someone who had spent decades in the classroom with students teaching them how to brew great beer. And so objects like that really kind of bring the story of their maker or their user with them, that's what I'm looking for.
We're talking to historian Teresa McCullough about the American Brewing History Initiative at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Teresa, in your travels, you have been through Wisconsin, a key part of brewing history. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were looking for here?
Absolutely. Well, you know, as soon as I got this job, I knew that a stop in Wisconsin would be obligatory because Wisconsin really, again, it kind of encapsulates all eras of American brewing history, that you have this great 19th century story of immigrant brewers who came to this country and really made brewing a profitable profession, and many of them settled in the upper Midwest because the climate was favorable to lager brewing. That was certainly not the case in the Mid-Atlantic or the South, and so the conditions were really perfect in places like Wisconsin. But then following Prohibition, then you have the story of brewery consolidation, and so then you have macro breweries like Miller Coors, which is still brewing and a very important figure in the industry, still there in Milwaukee today. And then now you have this new this new wave of craft breweries that are opening all over the country, including in Wisconsin. And so I visited places like Good City Brewing Company in Milwaukee, which the owners there really show this strong sense of investment and commitment to revitalizing the neighborhood around them. One of the founders, David Dupuy, told me that he sat around with his friends and his wife several years ago, and they literally made a commitment to the city of Milwaukee to stay there to improve it, and they're doing that through their brewery. But then you have a real kind of diversity of stories also that you can find elsewhere in the state. For example, I visited AJS Tap Handles in Random Lake, Wisconsin, which makes 80% of the tap handles that you might see in American food and drink establishments. And it's a really interesting place where the art director is really kind of the kind of middle person between the consumer and the brewer. And, you know, if you walk into a bar, especially if you have a lineup of unfamiliar beers, you know, you might look at the tap handle to decide what you might want to order. And so really there are all kinds of stories that are available in this state in a really interesting way.
And when you go to a craft brewery or a tap handle manufacturer or you name it, are these people who really want to tell their story?
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, everywhere I go, I just encounter this enormous enthusiasm and excitement that the American History Museum has this collecting initiative. There's a sense that beer has been a bit overlooked. You know, it's for historical reasons, it's kind of developed the reputation of an everyman's drink, and in a way that is true because beer is the most consumed alcoholic beverage in America. But, you know, certainly in the last 50 years, the American brewing industry is the most innovative in the world just in terms of the flavor profiles of beers that are produced here. And so I just have encountered amazing excitement and, you know, curiosity about what's happening here in D.C. and what I do when I travel around the country.
We've been talking about craft brewers for the most part, and there are so many of them, it seems like it's impossible to keep track of those. But how about home brewers? There are probably even more of those, and we'll never see their product in a bar or on a shelf.
Well, and, you know, it's great that you ask about that, because the craft brewing movement really began with home brewers. We would not have beer in America today if we did not have home brewers. It was in the immediate aftermath of, after Prohibition, when breweries consolidated, and there were home brewers who kind of continued to tinker at home, even though home brewing remained illegal after Prohibition's repeal. And it was in the 50s and 60s, especially following travels abroad, whether for military service or educational purposes, that some home brewers found beers in places like Belgium and Germany and England and Scotland that they wanted to replicate and bring back home to American soil. And so they brought homebrewing guides back with them, even brewing equipment. And when people like Fritz Maytag, when he revitalized Anchor Brewing Company, he was brewing styles like porter and barley wine that were being made in Europe, but not necessarily America. And so it's homebrewers who really kind of began this, you know, had this compulsion to make beer better and then ultimately to turn professional. And so the American Homebrewers Association now has more than 43,000 members and is extremely active. And, you know, I just returned from the Great American Beer Festival in Denver, and there are many opportunities where homebrewers collaborate with professional brewers, and professional brewers will scale up expert recipes from homebrewers. And so there's actually quite a lot of movement in between the homebrewing and the professional craft brewing sectors.
You used the word tinkering a few moments ago, and that makes me think, like, if there was a stock American character of the 19th century, it might be the tinkerer, the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court type of person. When you visit these homebrewers and these craft brewers who are, you know, reinventing the wheel on purpose in a lot of cases, do you see them fitting into that kind of American tradition?
Well, you know, I think there has always and continues to be a sense among craft brewers that they are small. They're kind of working hard at home to make beer that is better than what they can get from a very big producer. That there's always been a strong sense of camaraderie among home brewers and craft brewers, you know, to the extent of sharing ingredients or mentoring each other, offering you know, kind of internships or relationships, means to learn and teach about brewing. But, you know, when I interview, especially when I sit down to record oral histories with brewers and I ask them how, what kinds of influences led them to this point, I'm really struck by the extent to which many of them cite a background in science. You know, perhaps they study biology or chemistry in school. Many of them love to cook. They say that brewing is much like cooking. Many also speak about the importance of travel in really shaping their palate. And, you know, so I certainly think there are common influences or experiences that, you know, could point someone toward brewing as a profession.
And, Teresa, before we wrap up, on a personal level, have you discovered a lot of great new beers to drink yourself?
I have, yes. And, you know, I, as I like to say, history first, happy hour second. But when as part of my travels, it's a great, you know, a privilege when I tour a brewery, especially if a beer is not available in the D.C. area. You know, sometimes a brewer will send me home with a can of beer or something and say, you know, bring this back to D.C. and, you know, pack it carefully in your suitcase. So that has, it's been, you know, a really wonderful way to honor and, you know, sample the work of many of these entrepreneurs who have been so creative and so successful.
Teresa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Teresa McCullough is the historian of the American Brewing History Initiative at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. She was with us to talk about her research into the recent history of beer and a trip to Wisconsin as part of that.